Good afternoon and welcome to From Where We Are, stories of news and culture through the lens of USC and Southern California. I'm Waylon Cunningham, coming to you live from Studio B, USC's Annenberg Media Center.
And I'm Michaela Stevens. It's February 10th. On today's show, voting began today in USC's undergraduate student government elections. We'll also look at the updated high-tech ways we'll vote in California's primaries in a couple weeks, and celebrate the historical wins at the Oscars for the South Korean film Parasite. All that and more from Where We Are.
After last Monday's botched Iowa caucus results, the next state on the road to the Democratic nomination is New Hampshire. Current polls from New Hampshire put Senator Bernie Sanders in the lead, with former Mayor Pete Buttigieg in second. Data averaged by 538 today has Sanders leading by 6 points over Buttigieg, with these two quite a bit ahead of the rest of the pack. Here's more from Gabriella Tagliani on why the New Hampshire primary matters in California.
The results of the Iowa caucuses still aren't official, but it's a tight race between Senator Bernie Sanders and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Both candidates have strong supporters at USC who say that what happened in Iowa won't necessarily affect what happens in New Hampshire.
I think definitely there's a little lack of faith in the system in Iowa, so hopefully in New Hampshire they, you know, kind of are a little bit more efficient and have it all handled, which it should be fine because I don't think they're trying anything new like Iowa was trying this year.
That's Rachel Maltz, president of Students for Pete at USC. She says despite the caucus mess, it still is important for voters to follow what happens in early caucus and primary states.
So I think in most elections, it may not matter quite as much, but since electability is the number one issue for voters, just in most polls, I think that it will have a slightly bigger impact than usual because these are the very first contests. I think it's really great that we have these early contests because the winners are able to kind of say, well, see, now I am electable because I was just elected by these people.
Supporters of Bernie Sanders on campus, like Trojans for Bernie co-president Aya Nassif, agree that Iowa and New Hampshire could matter for students in California.
Well, I think a lot of people do look going into Super Tuesday. A lot of people do look at Iowa and New Hampshire, despite their demographical differences, as a great, not necessarily since their delegates ultimately don't really matter since they're both very small states, as a good marker to or a good way to get in leverage into Super Tuesday or the Nevada caucuses. If the results isn't as contested as it was in Iowa, whoever does come out of it with a clear lead is more set to do favorably in any of the other states.
A recent KQED poll published at the end of January shows Sanders with a large lead in California among likely voters. The California primaries are scheduled for March 3rd. For Annenberg Media, I'm Gabriella Taglioni.
California primaries begins February 22nd. For those voting in person on March 3rd, this year, voting will be modernized. If you're in LA County, the new system will change how and maybe even where you vote. Reporter Rebecca Katz has more.
Buy a stylus, hanging chads, and ink. Los Angeles has gone digital. This year, instead of punching a ballot, voters can tap tablets to select their candidates instead. It's been several years in the making, an overhaul that officials say cost $300 million to a system that hadn't been updated in decades. Now, the voting booths will be equipped with touchpad ballots with larger type and audio headsets in 13 different languages. The new system also gives folks the options to vote anywhere within the county. You are no longer tied to just one voting site. Although thousands of historically known polling places will not be used in this election cycle, some odd new spots have popped up around the county. If you're in Hollywood, vote at the Hollywood Hotel. You're craving a baguette? There's a poll in a French restaurant in Santa Clarita. Need a new car? You can even vote at an auto dealership in Burbank. The goal? Officials say convenience, flexibility, and more votes. For Annenberg Media, I'm Rebecca Katz.
Christian Colmenares also reported on the story. Now, for me, I actually have to confess something. I have not registered to vote in the primaries yet, and I feel terrible about it, and I'm desperately hoping that there's still time.
Oh my goodness. So were you registered? You just moved here, so you haven't registered here yet? Like, are you registered home or?
I am registered at home, and to be honest, I haven't updated my DMV information either because I don't want to pay the California insurance rates. But it might come time to choose between my love of democracy and wanting, you know, being willing to pay that. Anyways, USC's Undergraduate Student Government, or USG, begins its elections today. Last year, only about 1 in 4 students even voted. Believe it or not, that was an increase from the turnout the year before. So we wondered, what does USG do? And why should you care? Here's reporter Christian Coleman-Ares.
The Undergraduate Student Government, also known as USG, is holding their presidential debate tomorrow evening, yet many students are unaware of what USG is and their importance on campus. When I asked students to show me where the USG office was, most were clueless.
I cannot.
I have no idea where USG office is.
I'm unaware of where the USG office is.
Many students were left guessing as to what USG even does.
It's the student government, right?
I'm going to assume it's some student body government, but I don't really know what they do.
Oh, is that the student government?
The uncertainty in these students' voices speaks volumes. USG stands for Undergraduate Student Government. They act as liaisons between students and faculty, plan large campus events, and fundraise. All that is to say, they handle a lot of the school's money. $500,000 in funds for research, student orgs, and professional development. In fact, USG handles a budget of nearly $2.5 million. That's according to their website. But where does all this money come from?
I believe the university, but I'm not sure.
Sophia Kettering is a former member of the funding branch in USG. She doesn't know. At the USG office, I spoke to Alexis Bennett. She's a current peer leadership member. Alexis gave a good breakdown of the structure of USG and the process of how they request funds. But once again, when I asked where the money comes from, she simply said,
I am not sure.
Here's the thing. USG is entirely funded by students' tuition dollars. A portion of every student's USC tuition is made up of the undergraduate student programming fee, which goes straight to USG. But only 24% of undergraduate students voted in last year's USG election cycle, according to Daniel Hamm of the Daily Trojan. Many students are not deciding how their own tuition money is being used on campus and have little participation in deciding which candidates will be in charge of this money. After telling students about where USG funds come from, I asked if they might attend tomorrow's debate.
I will not be.
No, I mean, I wasn't planning on it. I knew it was happening, but... I have certain other matters to take care of.
So I guess that's a no. If you do have the time, you may want to see how your money will be spent. For Annenberg Media, I'm Christian Colmenares.
To learn more about the candidates and their platforms, see our interactive article on uscannenbergmedia.com. Voting will close this Thursday at 11:59 p.m.
Amid all of the drama with the Democrats, Trump released his 2021 budget request yesterday. This will be his last budget proposal to Congress before the presidential election in November. So, what does it say? The plan is similar to his previous requests. More spending on military, security, and immigration enforcement. Less spending on education, environmental protection, and housing. But even with big cuts in Medicaid and the EPA, the Congressional Budget Office says President Trump's budget would not eliminate the deficit until 2035 because of low tax revenue.
The California Department of Justice announced yesterday that they will conduct their own investigation into the Los Angeles Police Department's use of CalGang, the statewide database of alleged gang members. In January, many officers assigned to special patrols here in South Los Angeles were suspected of lying to get certain residents onto the list. The scandal was not a surprise. One African-American resident of South LA underwent a lawsuit last year after being wrongfully put on the list. A Los Angeles Times investigation also found that African-American drivers were stopped at a rate 5 times their share of the city's population last year. The DOJ will be investigating up to 20 officers.
Bong Joon-ho's Parasite made history at this weekend's Oscar ceremony, upsetting the heavily favored war drama 1917 for the award for Best Picture. The South Korean thriller is the first foreign language film ever to win the Academy's most prestigious prize, and also snagged awards for Best Original Screenplay, Best International Feature Film, and Best Director. Bong, who was nominated for the first time ever, gave shout-outs to co-nominees Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino before delivering one of the night's most memorable quips.
Thank you. I will drink until next morning. Thank you.
NOAA cameras went around campus to hear what students had to say about The Parasite's big night.
Very cool to see a foreign language film win Best Picture. I know Roma won a lot of awards last year, but not Best Picture. Best Picture is like the pinnacle of the Oscars, so kudos.
I mean, it was crazy, you know, not only is it the first foreign film, but like they won four last night. You know, that's absolutely unbelievable, and it shows like how much our culture is moving, and I love it.
I thought that it was great that a foreign language film won, and it was a movie about like capitalism and how it affects families, and I think it's just opens the door to more like foreign language films to come in.
I think it's great because it's the first international film that's not spoken the English language to win. I think it was an awesome job. I also thought that I think it was the producer that was speaking. I also enjoyed his speech in recognizing the other producers like Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino, calling them out and just like saying like his memories that he had of them when he was coming up himself.
That was Sam McGowan, Alan Chan, Diana Balbuena, and Quillen Sortino. That was Sam McGowan, Alan Chan, Diana Balbuena, and Quillen Sortino.
Now, Michaela, did you actually watch the Oscars?
I did watch it, but I have to be honest, I was falling in and out of sleep a little bit.
Yeah, you and a lot of Americans. I've heard it's supposed to have been one of the lowest watched Oscars in history.
Yikes. So,
I actually watched it. I had a pretty good time. Billie Eilish was my favorite, actually. She made these shocked expressions the entire time. USC's School of Cinematic Arts, or SCA, also has a strong presence in Hollywood, with four nominees in this year's Oscars. Perhaps nowhere is the influence of SCA more evident than in the Hugh Hefner Moving Image Archive. It contains thousands of classic films and artifacts. And it's on campus. But not many people know where to find it. Reporter Zosia Millman visited the archive underneath the Norris Theater.
That's the classic sound of a Bell & Howell film camera. You probably haven't heard it in a theater recently, because it's a few decades old. It's one of the many old cameras, paraphernalia, and films that make up the Hugh Hefner Moving Image Archives on USC's campus. Below the Norris Theater, it feels almost like a different world, and that's sort of because it is. Here, in the air-conditioned wonderland, live about 85,000 reels of old film, according to archivist Dino Everett.
We're in the main film cage, which is racks and racks of films and tapes, going up in some places probably like 12 feet high. And yeah, this is where we keep all of the material that we've been taking care of for going back to the 30s.
The stuff you'll find in here isn't necessarily name brand. Sure, there's the soundboard from The Jazz Singer, but you'll also find about 23,000 student productions and another 25,000 educational films. The archive also takes in random collections and works to restore films that are in bad shape.
We recently restored a film from 1898 called Something Good Negro Kiss, which was the earliest on-screen example of African-American intimacy.
Everett says archives like the one at USC might not be needed if the studios had done a better job of protecting their films.
I like to look at it as we need to protect things for the future, because we don't know what's going to be important in the future.
He shares that philosophy with the creator of the vault, Herb Farmer, who started as a student at USC in 1938. At the time, the school was making what it called filmless films.
Which essentially was just sort of, they were going through the motions of making movies, but not actually making movies.
It was Farmer's Bell & Howard that became the vault's first camera. And over his 71-year career at USC, he just kept amassing things. Eventually, USC wasn't making enough money from selling educational films, and the archives found themselves in need of a new patron. In 2007, it got exactly that. $2 million from noted film enthusiast and Playboy publisher, Hugh Hefner. Back at the vault, Everett is still always on the lookout for new collection items. He doesn't get a lot of visitors from USC, but he believes it's worth the trip, especially for cinema students.
I always say, hey, you should really know more about things that were made in the past because you can steal from them. You know, every time you think you came up with the world's most original idea, you'd be shocked to find out that somebody may have done it before.
So the next time you're in need of inspiration, stop by the Moving Image Archives. Who knows what you'll find? For Annenberg Media, I'm Zosia Millman.
Valentine's Day is just around the corner, but unfortunately, not all dates can be perfect. Ayanna White asked USC students to share their bad date stories.
A bad date or like the bad date?
My worst date was probably when this girl and I went to In-N-Out and I ended up paying for it because she told me she didn't have money. She didn't even say thank you.
I went out with a friend I hadn't seen in a few years and we had gotten ice cream and everything was going smoothly, very friendly, until the end when he slowly took my hand and grasped it and said, wow, our hands fit perfectly.
I bought her a double-double and some french fries, which was $7. To me, that's a lot of money because I consider myself a very frugal guy, and she still didn't say thank you. But she ate it with such joy and gratitude.
This one time, I went on a date with a guy who just couldn't stop talking about feet. He was like a crazy feet fetish kind of guy, and it was so embarrassing because he kept checking out only my feet.
The entire time, all she could talk about was her ex. That was literally it. I think I got like one or two notes in. I tried to like change the subject probably like four or five times. But yeah, after a while, it's just like, hey, you know what? This guy sounds great. You should go talk to him again. And then I was like, but I'm going to go. And so I left.
I met this girl. We went downtown for a nice Italian dinner. It was going great. Had a great conversation. I made the flex, put my card down. The guy took it. We kept chatting. He came back and said it was declined. I ran out of money, and I didn't have another card. So then she had to pay for my dinner, and I had to wait until I made more money to Venmo her back. And it was pretty embarrassing.
Did you go on a second date?
We did, actually, yeah. So I guess it worked out.
We heard from Reed Scherenberg, Eric Ban, Marlies Duncan, Domini Kausik, and Charlie Convoy.
You're listening to From Where We Are. I'm Michaela Stevens.
And I'm Waylon Cunningham. Coming up, we'll hear how some USC students spoke out to protect LGBTQ plus rights in response to a demonstration from the Westboro Baptist Church, the latest on the Varsity Blues college admissions scandal, and a clip of USC Thornton's Afro-Latin American jazz ensemble.
Based in Topeka, Kansas, the Westboro Baptist Church has been known to demonstrate against the LGBTQ plus community and various religious and political groups. On Monday morning, they raised their signs just across the street from USC. Juan Vega de Soto has the story.
Members of the Westboro Baptist Church came to USC's campus on Monday morning as part of an effort to picket schools in Los Angeles. Their group consisted of four or five protesters, amongst them children. USC students supporting LGBTQ rights met them with a protest of their own, chanting and standing together against a church that preaches anti-queer propaganda. According to an eyewitness, around 50 or 60 people showed up to counter-protest the church supporters. USC student Tahira Beg was there this morning and shares her experience.
A lot of people that were sharing stories today, you know, spoke about trauma that they've experienced. You always receive strength from that. I mean, everything that you go through, any difficulty you go through, you receive strength from that. So I think there were a lot of empowered people in that group today.
The picket was planned for 40 minutes, according to their website, but church members left early. Passersbys showed their support for the counter-protesters by honking car horns and fist-bumping them.
That was surprisingly one of the more heartwarming moments of today for sure, because that just shows that like strangers who know nothing about you or your past are also here to support you, because we all come from this understanding that, you know, it is love, not hate.
The Westboro Baptist Church's appearance in Los Angeles consisted of visits to Alexander Hamilton High School, Manual Arts Senior High School, USC, and UCLA. For Annenberg Media, I'm Juan Vega de Soto.
A Boston federal judge has passed the harshest sentence yet to a parent involved in the Varsity Blues college admissions scandal. Juan Vega de Soto reports on the latest developments.
Last Friday, former investment firm CEO Douglas Hodge was sentenced to 9 months in prison. It is the heftiest sentence in the Varsity Blues admissions scandal yet. Hodge paid admissions scandal mastermind Rick Singer $850,000 to bribe coaches to get four of his seven children in as fake athletic recruits. Two of them got into USC and the other two into Georgetown. Hodge pleaded guilty in October on two counts: money laundering conspiracy and conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud and honest services mail and wire fraud. Prosecutors had called for a 2-year sentence, describing him as, quote, among the most culpable parents charged for his repeated involvement in the scam. The defense cited Hodge's donations to charity totaling over $30 million in the same period of time as proof that he merited a more lenient sentence. Hodge had funded an orphanage in Cambodia and donated to help underprivileged students get a better education. Federal Judge Nathaniel Gordon said he planned to sentence Hodge to a year in prison, but gave him a, quote, discount for these actions. For Annenberg Media, I am Juan Vega de Soto.
Federal prosecutors also released the falsified crew resume that helped Olivia J. Giannulli secure her admission into USC. The fake resume highlights Olivia's rowing career as an accomplished rower. Annenberg Media reached out to former USC crew team member Madeline Ottilie for her perspective on the resume's legitimacy.
It's crazy because it looked really similar to mine, because a lot of the races that she said she'd raced in were races I actually competed in high school. Having a resume like that would have reflected a high school career that came with a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice, and a lot of practice. And there are so many coxswains out there that work so hard to get those few spots on a college recruited team.
The next two status conferences for Lori Loughlin will be on February 27th and May 2nd. According to the AP, prosecutors are hoping for an October trial date for Loughlin, Giannulli, and others charged in the admission scandals. Caregivers at Keck Hospital want change. Holding picket signs, voices booming, they protested today in front of the Health Science Campus in Boyle Heights. Reporter Henry Davis has the story.
Hands off our PTO!
Hands off our PTO!
Hands off our PTO!
Staff at USC's Keck Hospital have had their sick time packed with their personal time. The hospital says the change adds consistency to their employment policies. The staff unions say it's a violation of their contract.
All of a sudden, they decided just to roll this out without any previous notice, and it's just a punitive, very punitive policy that, as you can see, everyone's very upset with.
That's Rudy Cuellar, a representative from the California Nurses Association, one of the staff's two unions. Ken Zolita, a nurse at the hospital attending the protest, explained his frustrations.
My actually biggest gripe with this whole thing is cutting kin care hours, or lumping kin care hours with our PTO hours. USC is collectively now saying that we're only allowed 96 hours total with PTO and kin care. I mean, you're telling me that, like, if my daughter gets sick or if my wife gets sick, then I'm only allowed 96 hours in a full year. California law says up to half of your accrued PTO. You know, this to me does not make sense. I don't understand how USC would be able to supersede California law.
But hospital officials tell a different story. William Martin Sargent, Keck's chief operations officer, says the change is a matter of convenience.
We did not change the benefits of our employees, okay? This is a policy change on how we use the benefits. And we have a variety of employees across the medical center. And it was important for us to be able to have a consistent policy that we can look to that provides our managers the opportunity to manage more effectively to really allow our caregivers the opportunity they have. Now, how does this picket? It's a point for us to listen to our employees.
Hands off our PTO!
Hands off our PTO!
The union's contract with the hospital expires next spring. For Annenberg Media, I'm Henry Davis.
Ampersand.
Now it's time for Ampersand Radio, a segment specializing in arts and culture stories. Have you heard about stands? You most likely have, even if you don't know the word. You know about the people who go wild for their favorite artist on social media and are always at the front row of concerts. But that's not the only aspect of someone being a stan. Reporter Maya Hairston comes to us with the full story.
Rapper Eminem coined the term stan. In this context, his stan was a crazy stalker. Anyways, I hope you get this, man. Hit me back, just a chat. Truly yours, your biggest fan. This is Stan. Now, Stan means super fans. They will go above and beyond for their favorite artist. Nothing is more important. And if you say something remotely negative about their fave, it can get ugly. Death threat ugly. Ask Nicole Caron, wife of Golden State Warriors owner, who leaned over Beyonce to ask Jay-Z his drink order. Fans made death threats to Nicole because they thought Beyonce looked annoyed. However, there's a love behind the perceived madness. I know, I'm a stan. Certified beehive. I've slept outside, waited in long lines, spent $7,500. P.S. That number does not include travel. All because of my love of Beyonce. She means a lot to me. Her music helped me through some dark times. Really dark times. I thought I would never know happiness again. I was living because of the music, living for the music. She's my inspiration, a light. So when I see other stands, I get the passion behind the madness. And there are a ton of stand-ups, like Rihanna's Navy, Taylor Swift's Swifties, and Nicki Minaj's Barbs, short for Barbie. The story in the media is always, these people are crazy. You went to how many shows? You spent how much to get front row tickets? But that's not the real story behind the reason why they stan. This is the reason.
You know, you hear a lot of sayings and phrases in your life that don't really mean anything until you have something to connect them to.
This is Rachel Miga, a Shawn Mendes stan.
But something that I have, like, gained from this fandom is, like, really learning that music does bring people together.
People who were once strangers have now become family. It feels like you can have a more intimate conversation with stans than other people you meet. I met one of my best friends, Jill, at 5 a.m. in Times Square for the unveiling of a Beyonce billboard. For Miga, it's a girl named B, who she met through Stan Twitter and has now become one of the most important people in her life.
There are so many things about her that I, like, strive to, like, find in myself. And she just, like, is a good person to be around. And we FaceTime a lot and catch up and, like, talk literally all the time.
Being a stan is hard work and expensive, but the connections is what really makes what we do worth it. For Annenberg Media, I'm Maya Hairston.
For more stories like this, visit Ampersand online at ampersandla.com. You're listening to USC Thornton School of Music's Afro-Latin American Jazz Ensemble. They play Afro-Cuban-influenced Latin music from both the 1970s New York salsa scene and 1980s Latin jazz. Last night, they performed at the Carson Center on campus. Let's tune in. That's all we have time for on today's From Where We Are. Zazu Lippert and Rebecca Katz produced today's show. We had help today from Isaiah Murtaugh.
Yuki Leong is our board operator. Derek Renfro composed our theme music. Subscribe to From Where We Are on Apple Podcasts.
And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Annenberg Media. I'm Waylon Cunningham.
And I'm Michaela Stevens. Wherever you are, we hope you'll join us again next time for From Where We Are.